there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is another call with yet another potential client. Hope you're not getting tired of these by now. And this one was a lot of fun for me because, as you'll be able to hear in a moment, Sunny, that's his name, knows his stuff really well. Not only Japan, he's married to a Japanese spouse, not only Fukuoka City, which is the main focus of our conversation, that's where his wife is originally from and it's a city that he regularly visits, but also because he's already owning and investing in properties elsewhere in the world. And so we talk about purchasing properties in Fukuoka City, and he's actually in the market for a few things, a property to be used personally when they visit, investment properties, and also the potential to set up a fund for Singapore buyers, which he could then potentially leverage for potential financing from Japanese lenders. So we talk about a lot of stuff. Firstly, about property sizes, what works for investment purposes as opposed to personal use, houses versus condos from the same perspective, how loans work in Japan, both on a commercial and individual capacity. And then more meta stuff, price trends, yields, locations, buying secondhand versus constructing a new property. And of course, also a fair bit about who we are at NTI, what services we provide, how much they cost, what the difference is between us and realtors, and how people can draw on our expertise and support, even when they're purchasing on their own. And then we finally chat a little bit about the fund or the joint venture company idea. How would that work? How much would it cost to set up? What would be the best corporate structure, both from a financing and tax perspective? So a lot of good stuff to unpack in this one. Listen carefully. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Let me bring up your email again. So you're talking about Fukuoka City for personal use, but also for investment?
Yeah, so my agenda is primarily to find a sustainable unit in Fukuoka. My concerns are kind of broad. So one is I need a single unit that is above 100 square meters built up area.
So everything, when you say unit, does it need to be a condo unit or a house?
It can be either one. I mean, location is key for me. I have gone to see several units in the area where I live, which is, you know, a very nice area in terms of, it's about 10 to 15 minutes walking distance from Hakata Station and about 25 minutes from Tenjin Station. So I'm kind of like right in between. But it's a rental unit. I've gone to see, there's a property company called, several property companies. One of them is called Show Flat or something like that. Open House. Yeah, it's called Open House.
Okay.
I think a large property company. What they do is they buy individual derelict homes. So they buy the land and then they break it up into two units and then they build two, three-story walk-up units, right? So these units are just way too small. I mean, you're talking about four bedrooms, 85 square meters, three floors. It's not sustainable. So I'm looking for something that is livable, comfortable.
These floors, you'll be running up and down all day long.
Oh yeah, and it's dangerous and not sustainable. As you get older, it doesn't become a livable asset.
Or drunk, I can imagine.
Well, you know, booze is cheap in Japan, so yeah, that happens a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's my first thing, right? How do I find a suitable place that is above 100 square meters of livable space?
To purchase or to rent?
To purchase.
And you're buying in cash, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so all property companies would be happy to sell a property to you in cash. The problem might be the cultural differences where somebody like us comes in, but the properties are out there. It's not like it's hard to find. Question is, what's your budget?
I mean, ideally, I would like to stick to $500,000. If I'm forced to go above that.
I don't think you would be in Fukuoka. But I mean, if you're buying in, you know, right on Momochi Beach in those towers, then maybe. But otherwise, yeah, shouldn't be an issue. My friend just bought a brand new one that's about the type you're describing in Island City. Are you familiar with Island City? It's like a big residential development near Kyudai, one of the Kyudai campuses in Higashi-ku. And there, I mean, but he bought serious luxurious tower living kind of thing. And even that, what I think about 300,000 brand new. So
that's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the center of the city, if it's brand new, maybe $500,000, but you're not looking for brand new, are you?
It doesn't need to be brand new. So my assumption is that brand new. Is that there is capital, significant capital depreciation. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's from a tax perspective. It doesn't actually mean that the property is no longer serviceable or that market price will be very low. The tax depreciation that you're talking about is from a tax perspective only. The prices tend to hold regardless of that. Sunny? Hello?
Sorry, Ziv, could you repeat that? I was having trouble with my headset, so I missed.
Yeah, so I'm saying the capital depreciation that you're describing is related to tax tables. In practice, if you're talking about market price, that doesn't really correspond with the depreciation life cycle. That's a completely different dynamic that drives those two.
Hmm. So what I've noticed is that, you know, two compounds facing each other, you know, equivalent square footage or square meters, one that is 30 years old is going for $350,000 USD, and the one that's opposite, that's 7 or 8 years old, is going for $500,000 USD. So I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure that, you know, I'm not getting a foreigner price because, you know, my wife and is Japanese.
No, it's not a foreign price.
Yeah. So I've kind of come to this conclusion.
That yeah, they do go down in they do go down in value, but it's not because of the tax depreciation. They go down in value because as the building gets older, maintenance costs start building up, and then if you're an owner occupier, the amount that you have to pay every month is increased, and if you're a landlord leasing the place out, then obviously if you're paying more monthly fees, then that reduces your yield. That's the reason the prices are decreasing. It's not directly related to tax depreciation. So if you look, for example, we usually don't deal with anything this old, but when we started, which was already 11 years ago, we did help a couple of customers buy in central Hakata properties that were built in 1970 something, I think. So 40, close to 50 years now. They've actually doubled in price since we bought them. Right. So first customer bought 11 years ago at, let's say, 2 million yen. Next customer who buys there 11 years later is buying it 4 or 5 million yen. Right. Obviously, the trend of Fukuoka becoming an attractive destination and prices going up trumps anything to do with depreciation if and when that happens. Right. So don't take depreciation as a market price reflection. Take it as a tax matter. So if you want to claim depreciation on your properties, then you might want to get something that's, let's say, between 10 to 30 years. If you want to purchase something from a tax perspective that's already officially depreciated, buy something older. But market prices will not be driven by that, or at least not by that alone. And the other factors that drive market market trends are usually stronger than that.
Understood. I mean, very, very good insights, right? As you but know,
putting all that aside, buying something that's 30 years and older does mean that you'll very quickly be paying a lot more on a monthly basis for maintenance and reserve funds.
So that will be important to understand what is that quantum of the maintenance and reserve funds, you know, an average threshold in comparison to your acquisition price of the property.
That's really hard to give a rule of thumb to, because the nicer the building is, the more maintenance costs will be. The older it is, the more renovation and repair costs will be. The bigger it is, it might have more elevators, which also, I mean, we've seen some properties where you're paying $100-$150 a month, and others where you're paying $300 a month, and they're not necessarily related to size and location. It's more related to how fancy or how old the building is. So I can't give you anything clear on that. We'll just have to look at them case by case.
But in terms of your opinion, your extensive expertise in the Fukuoka or the Japanese market, how do I get involved? How do I purchase something and at least give myself a guarantee, somewhat of a guarantee, of principal preservation, you know, with, you know, the potential upside of capital gains on the valuation of property going up?
Well, the first step for that would be location, for sure. Fukuoka has been doing very well capital growth-wise, but only in central suburbs. The outer suburbs have gained in value, but not nearly as much as the central ones. So that's the first one. The second one would be, I would buy something that's young enough so that when you're considering reselling it within, let's say, 7, 8, 10 years, it hasn't reached 40 years of age yet. So as long as you resell up to, let's say, 35, 34 years of age, you've got a much higher chance of preserving your capital. If you're selling older than that, that's getting into, I mean, investors at that point will be thinking about everything that I've just mentioned earlier, and then they will want to see the price reflecting that.
Understood. So one of the things that just popped in my head when you said that is that there is a 40-year threshold, and that 40-year threshold might be...
I mean, it's a moving goal stick. Yeah. Don't take it as
I know. Just so 40 years, I mean, not carved in stone, but it's kind of like a guideline. So if 40 years is a guideline of capital depreciation of the property asset, then perhaps buying a couple of 40-year-old two-bedroom units and then just renting them out, as long as they are in ideal locations in Tianjin or Hakata, might be a good move.
I wouldn't do that because, again, you can't really clearly estimate how quickly and how high the building fees will have to go up, number one. Number two, at around 40 years of age is when developers start sniffing around and trying to buy the building from under the owners. And in Japan, that's not a really attractive prospect. It can be in some very rare cases, but most of the time, because the... because the owners of properties in that unit are not necessarily going to be experienced investors or real estate savvy, so it's easy for the developers to run scare tactics and say, oh, you know, the building is getting really old. If you don't sell it to me at this price, you're not going to be able to sell it at all in 5 years. And they take their time. Sometimes they'll worm their way into the owner union by buying one or two units at a reasonable price and then start having votes on the owner union and being able to talk to people more. So within a period of 5-6 years, they will often be able to convince the majority that they need, which is about 80%, not about exactly 80% of owners. So if you bought the property 5 years ago, you haven't really made that much in rental income to cover for the potentially reduced price that you'll have to sell it for.
Yeah. So I think you've made another very, very good point, is that the property market in Japan is not as savvy as it is in other places. So the parallels that I'm taking are, of course, to North America and, you know, primarily to Singapore. which, and I think Singapore is...
Singapore is obsessed with property.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, if you just take 50% of the Singapore equation, I think that's the equation for Fukuoka.
Yeah.
If you take 50% of the San Francisco and the Irvine, California, Southern California, that would be the parallel to Fukuoka, because it's turning out to be the tier one secondary city.
Right? Correct.
So it's still ample land, still huge potential for growth. You know, the mayor is a rock star, and has been that way ever since he came into power. He's doing a lot of great programs with the startup program. And Tenjin Bank is actually no longer just a story or a fairy tale. It's actually being executed. I've seen the Fukuoka market, and I've engaged with, of course, the leaders in City Hall for more than a decade, and in and out of Fukuoka for 25 years. And, you know, damn, I wish I had acquired land assets even 10 years ago.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARKReform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
It would have doubled in value at least.
Yes, correct.
So I don't have a time machine, but I do see an interim window of the next 36 months as significant change in Japan. I mean, in terms of, you know, the Bank of Japan changing interest rates, in terms of, you know, the economy globally becoming weaker, there might be a good opportunity to capitalize on this. Most investors would have already secured the sufficient Japanese yen during the period up till, you know, a couple of weeks ago, right? Everybody's been just buying and saving yen.
Our customers definitely have been, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even my friends who are not even thinking about buying property in Japan, of course, a lot of them want to. It's just that they're confused. And they said, hey, you know what? You know, I spent 2 weeks in Japan. I went to see a whole bunch of things. I'm still totally confused. You know, I'm happy to put the money down because it looks cheap compared to what we pay in Singapore.
But how do I do it?
You know, I don't trust them, number one, because when language becomes a huge barrier. And of course, in a country like Singapore, everything is automated. I can just click on a government website. I can find out what the prices were for this particular property 20 years ago up till yesterday. I can click on an account, get to a bank manager, and the bank manager will give me an indicative valuation for that property. As in Japan, none of these things are
automated. No.
So it's very, very old school. We don't even have a centralized property platform, a portal, where we have the majority of
The agents do. The brokers have access to a national RAINS. It's called RAINS database that does have more information than we can find online as non-registered agents, but it's still nowhere near what you'd see the MLS in the US and what you're describing in Singapore.
Like in Southeast Asia, you just need to hit Property Guru and you see every single unit that's up for sale or rent, right? Commercial, yeah. Residential. Good point. Understood.
But the agents, bear in mind that when you're working directly with the realtors, they're Japanese. They're not swindlers. They're not going to run away with your money or anything like that. But they're still realtors. They're very transactional. So you will have to tell them exactly what information you want. And they're not going to tell you what questions to ask or hold your hand through due diligence. It's not what they're there for. And they're not going to, aside from a very rare few, they're not going to do that.
Understood. And
so you need to know what you're asking, and you need to know how to conduct due diligence on your own or through the assistance of somebody like us. But don't expect the brokers that you're working with to do that for you, because 99% of them won't.
So my understanding is that your business model is a single point of entry. So whether you want to do it as a personal acquisition or preferably as a commercial acquisition, you are the one single point solution. So you will have.
We need to be. I mean, we have people like you who have a Japanese spouse, and let's say sometimes after settlement, the spouses or the person themselves are happy to be receiving monthly property management reports, and you know, you've got an account, you can pay and receive income, so you might not need us after settlement. And some people, even during settlement, they want to do everything on their own. They found an agent that they can work with, but they want somebody to just provide consultation along the way and hold their hand. So we can fit into the purchase and management process at whatever capacity you need us to.
Understood. So now, in terms of my requirements for the personal use in Fukuoka, you know, not somewhere in the boonies or something, but something respectable enough that we are comfortable and happy to live in. You know, either a single property home or dual family home is what I'm very interested in.
Well, we'll look at prices, but I'm guessing in most cases, number one, a centrally located house as opposed to a condo unit is going to be more expensive. Obviously, because the land parcel is a lot bigger than what you get with a condo unit. And number two, bear in mind that building materials in Japan are not very durable. They're not meant to last within 25. So if we were talking about 40, 45 years for the concrete blocks, with houses, if you go beyond 25, 30 years, you're already going to see a very sharp escalation in average maintenance costs.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're quite flimsy here, and there's a bunch of reasons for that, but they're just, aside from some custom ordered constructions which are concrete or brick, most of them are just flimsy wood or steel framed wood at best. So if you want to keep tabs on your monthly costs, maybe a condo is better. But if you're in the mood for a house with a yard and, you know, a bit of distance from the neighbors, then, you know, we'll help you get whatever you want to get.
Yeah, I mean I'm open to both. It can be one at a time or it can be both at the same time.
You need two properties for personal use?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is to my wife is very close to her family. And I'm not in Japan most of the time. So what we're trying to do is if I decide to buy a condo unit, I'm going to buy two units so that, you know, they can always live together.
Close to each other, walking distance to each other.
Walking distance, okay. That's correct. If I was going to buy a large plot of land, then our plan was that I would build two separate homes on that plot of land. Gotcha. And then that would just be connected by a yard, right? So kind of like Canadian style.
Okay, so to give you a rough idea, constructing a home in Japan, if it's your average Japanese style home, let's say 3LDK or 4DK up to 120 square meters, say standard construction materials, is probably going to be between 20 to 30 million yen, depending on how custom made you need it. So correct. You're talking about buying the land, which I'm assuming is going to be at least 40, 50 million yen if it's central, and then constructing two houses there for, let's say, 25 million each.
Each, correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. So we did go and see a couple of these construction companies where they have ready built models. And then obviously you can customize the models a little bit, and then they'll come and basically drop ship a home there. You know, it's earthquake proof and blah, blah, blah. So I think that is kind of like the simple solution.
Was it cheap too?
But about what you were saying, you know,
okay.
200,000 to 300,000 US dollars.
So not a big difference there, just convenience, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But of course, I mean, if you have specific builders where we could build something even better for the same price, why not? I mean,
same price would be pushing it, but you'd get better quality for a bit of a higher price, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's about sustainability, right? You're building the primary home that you want to live in. So, of course, you don't want it to fall for, you know, the next 50 years. So, I'm sure people will be willing to pay a little bit of a premium on that, you know, barring it's justified.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's cover the next one. I mean, in terms of talking about specific units, we'll take it outside of the recording. But the next thing I'd like to talk about is, you know, your business model and this investment mandate. You know, I've seen, you know, postings from you and, you know, I met you, probably the first time I met you was, I think, 5 years ago or 3 years ago. Unfortunately, I was not committed to doing acquisitions in Japan as much as I am now. I suppose I'm motivated by the fact that I've accumulated too much yen and I got to do something with it.
Yeah.
So what's this whole business model? I mean, do I get, I've seen units that are, oh, this is 50,000 and it's amazing. It's a palace and, you know, minimum investment for returns is 4% or something yield and it's just 50% entry points. I mean, for me to go and put together.
You've been paying attention.
Yeah. For me to go and put together like 50 people just out of the Singapore network to say everybody put in 50 grand, we're going to have this new co in Japan and this new co will then be the owner operator and everybody gets a yield back from that company based on the number of shares that you acquire. But I mean, the quantum and the returns, nobody can guarantee, but there must be a justifiable range, right? After tax profits, right? Because most of us are illiterate in terms of what's the cost of establishment and maintenance of a Japanese co, right? I mean, in Singapore, anybody can open up a Singapore-based company for anywhere between $50 to $5,000 within 72 hours.
Yeah, you know, so same here in principle, but number one, it's not within 72 hours. It usually takes about 2 weeks. And if you're talking about shareholders who are non-residents, there'll be a lot of documents coming and going with notary public certificates and SAL because you're in Singapore and so forth. So that's probably going to be more towards a month, I would say.
Yeah, so one way I thought of bypassing these kind of issues was to create a new co in Singapore from which the investors invest.
A lot easier. Yeah, and also you wouldn't need to pay the minimum corporate tax that companies established in Japan need to pay. So as long as you're not making a taxable income, you'll save yourself like $700 a year or $1,000 a year or something of that sort. But bear in mind, so if you're saying about 50 people, 50,000 each, you're talking about 2.5 million Sing or US, whatever the case may be. That's worth setting up a corporate structure for. But if you're going to be owning assets that are, let's say, less than half or 600,000 US, the $3,000-$4,000 a year in annual upkeep and bookkeeping and accounting, which is what it costs to maintain a corporate structure in Japan, is probably not worth it. So financially, it would make more sense, unless anybody needs anything to do with residency or visas or whatnot, in which case maybe a Japanese structure is more advisable. But if we're just talking strictly investment, I think a Singapore company that's just a single entity buying in Japan and you divide the shares or the equity or the
dividend. The Singapore side, yeah. That would be a smarter thing, right? So that particular Singapore company has a wholly owned vehicle in Japan, and therefore, you know, it gives the.
No, you don't need the vehicle investors. In Japan. The Singapore company can own the properties directly.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
And you there's still you mean you get all the taxation,
legal recourse, taxation is corporate tax, same as any Japanese company. There's no difference.
But in terms of government grants, benefits, stipends, programs, you won't be eligible.
You won't be eligible, but I doubt you'd be eligible with foreign ownership, even if it's a Japanese entity. But that's something that's a bit over my pay grade. I have no idea about those.
Understood. So I'm sure you're also fully aware of City Hall's startup program and all the key stakeholders in there.
I know that they exist. I met a few of them. We're not in touch because on the few occasions that I did have customers who needed their support, to be honest with you, they were not very forthcoming. And I hear that's improving, but you have to be directly in touch, like you said, with decision makers. Just going to the next startup cafe and
that's a waste of time.
Not going to work.
So I for me, I mean, I am in direct communication with the senior management, the C-level there. But yeah, I mean, you're right. When it comes to Japanese, you know, kind of brainstorming a program out doesn't exist. You've got to literally give them point one, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and say, you know, yes, no.
So, and it has to be top down. You can't convince the people on the ground to start it. It has to be dictated.
Absolutely. Okay. Again, we can take that discussion further separately, perhaps over a coffee. All right. Were there other things that I wanted to cover in the email?
You were asking about how we work, I think. What's our business model?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So we're basically, as you already know, we're not a real estate agent. We're not a property management company. We are a proxy of the buyers, right? So we represent you or the company or whoever it might be in Japan, whether you're resident or not. We're the single point of contact in English, and then we utilize those third-party entities to do the work, right? So we work with the realtors, with the building management company, or the property manager, insurance company, what have you. We hook you up with an accountant, and then once you give us permission, then we just provide them with your documents, so you don't have to be involved in the provision of documents and the tax filing and all of that. And we charge separately as well. So first-time customers need to pay us our fee in advance of the purchase. And then we credit or debit, depending on what the end price ends up being, post-settlement. And then from the second purchase and onwards, you can just pay us on settlement.
Okay. So let's get into the nuts and bolts of that. The first thing is, in terms of these property investments that you recommend, what is the north and south of the yields that you can expect after tax per year?
Are we talking Fukuoka City specifically or Japan-wide?
Since, you know, other people may eventually listen to this, let's cover both topics.
Okay. So in Fukuoka, so when we're saying, are we going to be buying mostly entire buildings, mostly individual units? I wouldn't recommend houses. You mentioned about 50 times 50, so that's about 2.5 mil. That could probably get a reasonably central, reasonably not small, maybe medium-sized building in one of those locations. It's a very safe and stable asset. If it's mixed commercial, it's got a bit more diversity in tenant base. It's a good investment, but it would at most maybe make 3.5, 4% before tax.
Before tax?
Before tax. So after tax, maybe call it 3.5 or 3. If we're lucky, maybe 3.5 to 4.5 instead.
So where are the highest yields?
The highest yield that I can get in Fukuoka these days would be for either individual units or slightly smaller buildings, let's say up to 2 floors, up to 8 residential units, no commercial. Those could go up to 6 point something at best.
And
we interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
And those are interesting to me as well, because, you know, when you say like two floors or up to eight floors, something that comes with the land title, right?
Yeah, everything comes with the land title in Japan. Yeah. Not eight floors, eight units, I mean. So usually two or three floors at most, two or three units per floor.
And what was the yield on this that you said the best?
Best case scenario, about 6%, six point something.
After tax?
Before tax. Everything that I'm mentioning is net before tax, because I have no idea what your tax situation is going to be. That's depending on the structure, depending on how many years you've been claiming your carrying your losses forward. So I can't comment on your tax situation.
So if it was a new co in Japan, how much tax would they be liable for?
The corporate tax is basically fixed at approximately 20%. Let's call it between 20 to 26, depending on the amount of capital, the size of the company, size of the income, and so forth. But with a company, you can carry a lot more costs, and you can carry them forward longer than as an individual. So as an individual, you're limited to 3 years carrying of losses or costs, like purchase costs, setting up the company, or what have you. As a company, it goes up to 5 years. And there's more that you can claim. There's more people coming in and out of Japan. They could each have like a spouse or a relative that's supposedly working on the company and getting paid something. So there's just more claimable deductions with a corporate structure.
So yeah, so the best thing for small ticket items would be to set up a local Japanese new company.
It doesn't need to be local. Again, for that purpose, it can be a foreign company.
Can be a foreign company.
That's all claimable as well.
Okay. And the other thing that I was thinking about is loans. So in terms of the Japanese context, you know, it's global knowledge that it's the cheapest loan set in the world, barring, of course, you know, you might have to buy insurance on that loan in order to secure that loan.
Also, some of the hardest ones to get for non-residents, unfortunately.
So, but even for residents, right? I mean, the residents would need to have an employment track record or credit history
in Japan. Yeah.
In Japan, correct.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, the company could have an employment track record, and if you could do something like, I don't know if that's feasible in your situation, but if you do something like put your maybe wife as the representative director of the company, and she's a Japanese resident, it would be, down the track, it would be a lot easier to get loans because the representative director is a Japanese national and they can co-sign on the loan. It makes it a lot easier for the lenders to give it.
Yeah, but I mean, she doesn't generate income. I mean, she doesn't work, right? So how would she qualify for
loans? Well, if she's representative director of the company, she's assumably going to be getting some kind of salary on paper, right?
Ah, correct. Hold on there.
For that, though, it might be better to definitely better to establish the company in Japan.
And
what would be a lot more open to that if it's a local entity.
So what would be the guaranteed quantum that, you know, minimum down payment versus to get the loan? Would it be 30%, 70%, 50%?
Usually 20 to 30% for investment loans. If the company has a significant track record and it's very very profitable, then they would consider 100 up to 100%, 110 including closing costs, or 105, whatever it might be. But you would need, again, similar to an individual, you will need to show them that you've been alive and active and profitable for a good few years. So because for the first 5 years, again, you'll be claiming as much as you can from purchase costs and so forth to minimize your taxes, that's probably only going to be feasible after 6-7 years or so. That's when you'll start accruing taxable income, and that's when they'll start considering you. Or you could just not claim anything and try it after a year or two, but that doesn't make much sense financially.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm thinking that as long as each property to be purchased is financed above 50% in cash, then the banks would be more amenable to cover the loans. This will just allow you to spread your capital to purchase more.
It would, but they'll still need to see the company has been in existence and profitable for a while.
Okay.
And this is also a very dynamic landscape. So all the information I've just given you is based on the last few years of feedback from lenders. Everything could change. I mean, it used to be easier in the past. Then they all went to a Asia Pacific money laundering convention, and then all of them tightened their policies, and then they might loosen it up again in the future. I have no idea. But at the moment, that's what it seems to be.
Yeah, so I think if we're going to set something up for an individual level investment company, then you probably wouldn't go to City Hall, the startup program. But if you're going to invest a minimum of $500,000, I think, that's something that he would wake up on.
Definitely.
There is, I think, one very large property-related Singapore investment tycoon in Fukuoka. I remember he set himself up about 5 years ago.
Oh, living in Fukuoka, you mean?
But I'm not sure if he's cashed out everything and then shut that down, because he would have made a significant gain. I think at that time when he set up that company, he put in just $5 million. And I need to go and do a bit of digging to find out what he's doing, and then perhaps share that with you. All right, last thing to cover is your fees. So I do understand that there's a broad range of services, everything from, hey, you know what, we'll just translate everything for you, to we will handhold you and be your concierge throughout the execution.
Actually, the translate everything part is not something that we can do. We give you ad hoc summaries of what's in each document so that you know what it is that we're signing on your behalf. But if you want official translations, that has to be outsourced.
Yeah. Outsourced, correct. So in terms of your fees, if you were to handle a turnkey transaction, that means everything from identifying, secure
due diligence and doing the entire settlement,
And the entire settlement, barring the bank loans, excluding that because that's contentious. What would your fee range be?
It's not a range. So the budgets that you're talking about, I think each asset would be over 20 million yen or 200,000 US ish, right?
Correct
me. So that's always going to be 3% plus tax.
Okay. So that's 3%.
3.3, including tax.
3.3. Okay, now the next question is, in terms of the smaller units, because there's a lot of chatter that says that, hey, you know what, just buy these studios, these one bedrooms and these two bedrooms.
Yeah.
They rent out faster than you can, your name can dry on the paper. And it's just steady.
That's a bit of a misconception. It's not a super fast rental market. Obviously, if it's a central metropolitan property, it will stand a chance of being rented out much faster. But especially during COVID, we have seen them stand empty for 6, 7, 8 months. Normal times, I'd say, 2-3 months at most. It takes about a month to clear up and renovate and repair and start advertising. And then we start getting applications. So central metro properties, I'd say, assume 2 to 3 months.
So perhaps my view is jaded because, I mean, the apartment that we live in, I mean, it took us 2 years just to find an apartment here. And anything that comes up for sale, by the time you can get there, it's already sold. Anything
that you're not talking about studios, right? You're not living in one of those older, cheaper studios. Living in
this is a 5-year-old building that is a 3-bedroom unit, but then I removed one of the partitions to make it a 2-bedroom unit. And it's the total build-up area is only about slightly under 70 square meters.
Yeah, so that's your typical couple plus one child apartment for Japanese families, and they are in high demand. They're also very stable, good assets, but the yield is going to be very low if you buy those.
Oh, it's going to be low?
Low, yeah. Okay. The smaller, cheaper ones are a lot better on the yield.
Smaller, cheaper ones, yeah. So I've seen even just walking distance from me, surprisingly, there are a couple of like 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom smaller units, like 40 square meters, anything from 25 to 46 square meters.
That's again larger than most of the cash cows that we deal with. The real cash cows are going to be up to 25 square usually.
Wow. So that's what, that's about 50,000 a unit?
Central Fukuoka, they could reach 6-7 million yen if they're not too old.
Wow.
More suburban would be 4-5 million.
Okay. So that's something I would look at. I mean, that would just be, you know, kind of casual income.
Too new though, yo. They'll be about 20 to 30 years of age.
Well, as long as you can give me a yield and it's fully managed by your company and it's only 6-7 million a piece, you might as well pick up 2 or 3 of those, and then you're kind of building a track record. Put it under a company, and then put it under a company, and I'll put my wife as a director, as a full-time employee, so she takes that money, and therefore she's building up, some kind of track record.
And then open it up to shareholders down the track. That's not the best. Yeah.
Outstanding. So this is just 6-7 million, you say?
Yes. If you want the bank to take you a bit more seriously, maybe get a small building for that. So let's say 40-50 million, if you can afford that. That would make you look a bit more like a professional asset management company to them.
40-50 million.
You can start with the small ones and then grow over time. It's up to you.
Wait, 40-50 mil Japanese yen.
That will get you a small building in Fukuoka City, and not super central, suburban, but yeah.
That's just like what, 350,000-400,000 US?
At the moment, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about this as well. I think I need to buy you a long lunch, not just a coffee.
I didn't realize you were in Fukuoka. We should have met for lunch or drinks a while ago now.
Yeah, so
you were still
I come back to Fukuoka every 2 months for like 2 weeks.
Okay.
But you know, every time I'm back, I can't live in this tiny little. It drives me insane.
You're constantly out, are you?
Yeah, and then she's always looking at units, and they're always ridiculously small. You know, and it just doesn't make sense. So I said, you know, let me go get some commercial advice from somebody.
You need a bit of a mind shift there. Those smaller units that are not reasonable to you and me, like I would never live there as well. Even if I was single, I wouldn't live there. But those are the most coveted asset, because bear in mind that the Japanese tend to remain singles for life.
Mm.
So they're single when they go to university. They're single when they join a company. If they're lucky, they might get married and have one or one plus.
Mm.
But a lot of them remain single until they die, kind of thing, right? And those are the units that they live in, those up to 25 square.
Correct. So for me, all that stuff is fine as an investment vehicle, but not as a personal asset to live in.
Oh, shit, no. No. Of course not. Of course not.
Okay, cover the last thing. And hopefully I'm telling the truth now that it is the last thing. That miraculous one that you sent to me, this German guy just put in 50 grand and look at this amazing property. Yeah. And it looked like he owned, it was at the top of the mountain and he owned the whole thing. And to me, that was like, hey man, if for 50 grand, I have a permanent log cabin.
On Kurokawa Onsen Water too, but that's a resort property. So that, again, that comes with about $200 a month on average, $250 of resort management fees. Yeah.
Mm. So
you're paying for the onsen water, you're paying for the gardening, you're paying for the gated community, if it's a gated community, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. So these are like I said, right, a lot of people are sitting on spare Japanese yen right now. So these are things I would like to consider, that, you know, if there was a real strong value proposition, I would love to get like a beautiful log cabin in the middle of nowhere, not too far away from Fukuoka. Maybe do have.
When you say, sorry, when you say value proposition, what do you mean? Because you can't rent these out if they're on resort.
No. Not for rental. That's
a good value to purchase, you mean?
Holiday home. So I bought in 2022. And, you know, 10 years later, me and my son still go there. And we love to just live there.
That's not a problem. Right? Yeah.
That would be amazing. I mean, if you could do that for 50 grand. I mean, a beautiful log cabin in Wyoming probably will cost you 600,000 US. And then if you get it for 1/10 of the price in Japan, why not?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. I think you've covered a lot of things. And I'm going to stop the recording now so that we can cover the specific assets that I want to discuss.
Yep, go for it.
So there you have it. Again, really good savvy chat with someone who knows his stuff very well and also listens, which always tends to generate the best results. Hope you found as much value in it as I did. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.